presidential nomination. He didn't solve that problem, didn't eradicate those hard feelings during his first 3 days in the presidency, but by the end of those 3 days, he had certainly softened them. Wanting, needing to unify more than the party, from one telephone call to another, he shifted from one tone to another and back again. Had he told a liberal that he was going to ask Congress for less economizing? To the conservative Robert Anderson, he said he was going to ask Congress for more, to try to watch expenditures. With Democrats, he invoked Truman's name, telling Carl Albert he wanted to speak to a joint session similar to what President Truman had after President Roosevelt died. With Republicans, it was Eisenhower's name. He had just been in an elevator with President Eisenhower, he mentioned to Everett Dirksen. He had lunch with me and we were talking. It might be a good thing to have a joint session. Ike thought I ought to. Liberals, he told that they should support him because he was going to reform the system. Republicans, that he was going to preserve it. Hinting to them that because of things that had not yet come to light about the assassination, the system, under which of course their wealth had been accumulated, might be under attack, telling his key link to Wall Street, Ed Weissel, that your folks should be given a hint that this thing, this assassin, may have a lot more complications than you know about. It may lay deeper than you think. Oh, no, Weissel interjected. But that his folks shouldn't be afraid because we're going to preserve this system. Therefore, it was vital that the financial world show confidence in him. He himself called Frederick Kappel, president of the country's largest corporation, American Telephone and Telegraph, and chairman of the influential business council, to tell him, "We've got to preserve this system, my friend, and there's a good deal more." The key to the financial world was Wall Street. It had panicked on Friday on news of the assassination. Based on the experience with previous sudden presidential deaths, it would rebound when it reopened on Tuesday, as long as it had confidence in the president. Picking up the phone to call Bundy, Johnson told him that Treasury Secretary Dillon and Federal Reserve Chairman William McChesney Martin should make a statement about continuity, stability or something, and express their confidence before the market opened. After letting Weissel know that, "I've been visiting with President Eisenhower, and that I was thinking of you and I never needed you as much as I do now," he told him to tell Bobby, Robert Lehman of Lehman Brothers, and some of his group, "You just say that it's very tragic, but you have great confidence in me and my experience," so on and so forth. We don't want anybody to panic. And all the time, other calls were pouring in, from congressional leaders, from governors like Pat Brown, whose previous experience with Lyndon Johnson had been so unpleasant, but who now wanted to offer you all the help a governor can give to you. "Pat, you're wonderful, and I appreciate it, and I sure reciprocate it, my friend, and I've never needed help as bad as I need it now." From governors two at a time, John Reynolds of Wisconsin and Karl Rovog of Minnesota, both in Washington for the funeral, on the line at the same time. Mentioning that they had visited him on one of his trips to the Mayo Clinic, Johnson said, "You came to see me when I was sick. I don't forget. Now you let me know if there's anything I need to know out there. I'm going to depend on you." Of all the problems facing Lyndon Johnson, one of the most delicate, and to his mind, most urgent, was to persuade key Kennedy administration figures to remain in their jobs. While his plea on Friday that they stay on had worked with McNamara, Rusk, and Bundy, it hadn't with O'Brien, O'Donnell, or Sorensen. And on Saturday, it quickly became apparent how difficult it was going to be to keep with him some of the other most visible symbols of the administration. When early Saturday morning Johnson woke its public face, Press Secretary Pierre Salinger, to ask him to stay in his job, Salinger agreed to do so through Monday, telling his friend, the journalist William B. Shannon, that he would handle press arrangements through Monday's funeral because he wanted everything to go as smoothly as the president, he didn't mean the new president, would have wished. He said he would resign first thing Tuesday morning. As for Arthur Schlesinger, not a significant figure within the Kennedy administration, but to liberals, the very embodiment of liberalism, On Saturday, while President Kennedy's body was still lying in the East Room, he convened a lunch in a private dining room in Washington's Occidental Restaurant. Present, along with their wives, were Walter Heller, Heller's fellow economists Ken Galbraith, Sam Beer, and Paul Samuelson, William Walton, and Richard Goodwin. The topic was the possibility of denying Johnson the nomination at the 1964 Democratic Convention by running a ticket of Robert Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey. In trying to persuade the Kennedy men to stay in their jobs, Johnson had working for him, to a varying degree in each case, of course, fundamentals of human nature, the desire to hold on to position and power and the perquisites that came with them. But he was confronted, again to varying degrees, depending on the man he was talking to, with a quality not universal at all, the feelings of the Kennedy men about a dead leader who, as far back as PT 59, had elicited an unusual depth of loyalty in men who served under him. Almost all presidents evoke intense loyalty from their aides, a few something quite beyond, Eric Goldman says. These men had not only admired John Kennedy as president, but had been entranced by him as a human being, and had found a good deal of the excitement and of the meaning in their own lives through their feeling of closeness to him. On the evening of Kennedy's funeral, Schlesinger wrote in his journal, "I keep supposing that tomorrow morning I will come down to the White House, Evelyn will be in her office and Kenny in his, and in a few minutes the president will be along with some jokes about the morning papers. The thought that we will never see him again is intolerable and unacceptable and unendurable." To an unusual degree, the loyalty was to the man, and now the man was gone. "We came with him, we should leave with him," William Walton said. Complicating Johnson's task were the feelings of the Kennedy men about him, Lyndon Johnson. The contempt many of them felt for him exacerbated now by contempt for his state that had turned into hatred because it was there in that outpost of braggadocio and prejudice that their leader had been murdered. Walking into Ted Sorensen's office, Kennedy aide Ted Reardon shouted, "I'd like to take a fucking bomb and blow the fucking state of Texas off the fucking map." Sorensen wasn't a shouter. His quiet words to Reedy, "George, I wish to hell that goddamned state of Texas of yours had never been invented," let Reedy understand how deep his feelings ran. In addition, they had seen the way he treated his staff and the cost exacted by such treatment. Johnson really took from Walter Jenkins his substance, Ralph Dungan was to say. He is that way with people. He really took the substance, the psychological and spiritual substance of people, and sucked it right out like a vampire. He could not leave a man whole with his own dignity and his own self-esteem. And what programs would the new president ask them to support? They had believed not only in a president, but in a program, a liberal program, and they believed, many of them and perhaps almost all of them, that Lyndon Johnson was, despite his recent statements about civil rights, fundamentally a Texas conservative. Joining anyone else's team after working for John F. Kennedy wouldn't have been easy. Joining the team of Lyndon Johnson would be particularly hard. With each of them, Johnson employed the same basic line, "I need you more than President Kennedy needed you." Comparing notes, they realized they had all heard the line and mimicked it, exaggerating the Texas drawl, "I need you, really I do," laughing about it among themselves. And journalists would repeat their mockery, enshrining it in print as if Johnson was simply repeating the same line over and over. But, although no one realized it, in each case that line had been subtly altered, tailored to the man he was talking to, by this great reader of men. Tailored, for example, not only to Kenneth Galbraith's idealism, but also to his ambition to be what Kennedy hadn't allowed him to be, an insider like his friend Schlesinger. He, Lyndon Johnson, and Galbraith had both been young men in Washington in the early days of the New Deal, Lyndon Johnson reminded him. They had both believed in the ideals of the New Deal, he said. They both still did. Wouldn't Ken help him turn those ideals into reality? And he had that joint address to give to Congress, he said. He would appreciate it if Ken could get up a draft for him as quickly as possible. Tailored to Schlesinger's intellectual arrogance, I just want to say that I need you far more than John Kennedy ever needed you. He had the knowledge, the skills, the understanding himself. I need you to provide those things for me. You have a knowledge of the programs, the measures, the purposes, of the history of the country and of progressive policies. You know writers and all sorts of people. I need all that, and you must stay. With Adlai Stevenson, he played on ambitions, thwarted ambitions, and, it may have been, on regrets, on thoughts of what might have been. I know and you know that you should be sitting behind this desk rather than me, Lyndon Johnson told him. Played on resentments. There has been no consultation around here, he told Stevenson. You know they put in the tax bill without ever talking to me. I know they haven't consulted you either. So far as I'm concerned, that has all changed. I want you to play a big role in the formation of policy. And it wasn't just the line or the variations on the line, but the way it was delivered. He humbled himself before these men, abased himself. He wasn't as smart as Jack Kennedy, he told them. He needed them to think for him, to think. He didn't absorb things as fast as President Kennedy, he said. Don't expect me to absorb things as fast as you're used to. They would have to be patient with him, he said. When one of them suggested that because of the strain he was under, he should consider going to the ranch for a vacation over the upcoming Thanksgiving weekend, he said, I'm afraid to. I don't have enough time to keep abreast. I just haven't read one-third of the stuff I need to read, and I read until 2 o'clock in the morning. He pleaded with them. He was helpless because of his background, he said. In his notes on his conversation with Johnson, Heller wrote that the president had said that he did not have the education, culture, and understanding that President Kennedy had, but he would do his best. And because he didn't even know people as smart as them to staff the government. I don't know the kinds of people that we're going to need. I don't have anyone to replace you with, he told one man. Please stay. I don't know anybody, he said to another. In these early days, as Doris Kearns Goodwin puts it, he spoke to the Kennedy men with a subdued tone. He requested rather than ordered. He spoke of his shortcomings and shared his doubts. Evans and Novak, who interviewed many of these Kennedy men during this period, were to write in their study of Johnson and the exercise of power that, in these first few days, Johnson subdued his energy, lowered his voice, and assumed a posture of humility. Old friends and aides remarked they had never seen him so self-possessed, so humble. If the humility, the deference he showed was a mask, as it had invariably proven to be in the past, after he had cried in front of Jim Rowe years before, for example, it was a mask that in those crucial days never slipped. Men who had watched Johnson for years could hardly believe the depths of the humility they were seeing now. His one-time aide, Harry McPherson, was in the inner office in 274 when McGeorge Bundy entered with several cables and memoranda. They were not urgent, but the president should see them before evening. Johnson was extremely deferential. He said, "Whenever you need me, let me know." Bundy replied, "Oh, Mr. President, you let me know when you need me." That made sense. Presidents pushed the button to summon aides, not the reverse. But I wondered if there was, in his correct, fluid response, the tone of a professor gently chiding a student who'd got it wrong. Johnson gave no indication that he had noticed the tone. Kennedy aides gave him advice, lectures in some cases, so all-knowing was their attitude, on how best to get the tax cut and civil rights bill passed, lectures on legislative strategy to the master of the Senate. Johnson sat and listened attentively, earnestly. It seemed all he could do to keep himself from taking notes. Moreover, as Doris Kearns Goodwin says, never once did he permit himself even to imply that however things were done before, this was now his White House. Where one might have expected bitterness for all the slights received from some of these same men when he was vice president, Johnson showed only benevolence. In fact, quite deliberately, he was telling them that it was still going to be their White House. I knew how they felt, he was to tell Goodwin. The impact of Kennedy's death was evident everywhere, in the looks on their faces and the sound of their voices. He was gone, and with his going they must have felt that everything had changed. So I determined to keep them informed. I determined to keep them busy. I constantly requested their advice and asked for their help. Never once. His restraint, as Goodwin wrote, was continuous. Summing up descriptions of Johnson conversations they received from a dozen Kennedy aides, Evans and Novak said that his restraint was magnificent. And the restraint and humility got him what he wanted. Induced in these men the very cooperation and submission that Johnson was after, as Goodwin was to comment. By Sunday night, as one reporter wrote, he obviously had good news he wanted to share, and although he restrained himself from making the announcement himself, associates of President Johnson told reporters that President Kennedy's cabinet will be kept virtually intact until after the 1964 election. As for the Kennedy staff, Salinger had intended to brief the press for the last time on Monday. On Tuesday, he was still briefing. With swollen eyes, one reporter wrote. Adlai Stevenson had been so thoroughly convinced that he would be playing a big role in the formulation of policy that he couldn't resist gloating over the alteration in his status. Johnson and he talked the same language, he told Schlesinger. In fact, he felt that had he said the word, Johnson would have fired Rusk and Bundy. But I told Johnson that they should both be kept. You know, he told Schlesinger, things are 10 times better for me now than they were before. Adlai would remain as ambassador to the United Nations until his death in 1965. When, during his conversation with Schlesinger, Johnson saw that the historian's resistance might have withstood the need plea, he lightened the mood with a little joke, saying about Schlesinger's letter of resignation, "If you act on it, I will have you arrested." Still trying to demur, Schlesinger said that every president should have his own men around him. Johnson said, "I consider you one of my men." "I hope you will consider yourself that way too," Johnson went on. "I just want you to know that I have complete and unlimited faith and confidence in you. I want you to stay. I know it will be a sacrifice for you, and I know that you have many other things you can do. But I'm asking you, for my sake and for the sake of the country, to stay with me for at least a year. By that time, I hope I will have earned you the same confidence and faith which I know you had in John F. Kennedy." He said all this with simplicity, dignity, and apparent conviction, Schlesinger was to write in his journal that evening. "I'm a little perplexed as to what to do. I'm sure that I must leave, but I can see the problem of disengagement is going to be considerable." Disengagement was, in fact, to prove to be impossible, at least for a time. Schlesinger, still speaking frequently with Robert Kennedy about strategies for 1964, would remain in his White House office until the end of January. To the idealistic Sorensen, who despised him, "To me he personified the kind of hyperbole and hypocrisy that defined the worst aspects of politics in my eyes," he was to say. His appeal was based on Sorensen's loyalty to the Kennedy program and to his love for the man himself. When Sorensen mentioned that he had already submitted a letter of resignation, Johnson said, "I know, I got it." He didn't mention it again. Instead, he said, "I want you to draw the threads together on the domestic program." In another meeting, he asked him to draft the address to the joint session. These were the right notes to hit. "I agreed to draft the speech," he was to say. "I wanted to help commit LBJ to carrying on Kennedy's program for 1964 and Kennedy's legacy for the ages. And I wanted him to invoke these policies and words specifically, as well as the late president's name. And, in addition, I knew that JFK would not have approved my leaving during the brutal, grim post-assassination transition." Johnson was aware of the significance of his accomplishment. By remaining on the job, they helped give the government and the nation a sense of continuity during critical times, a sense of continuity which in turn strengthened my hand as chief executive, he was to write in his memoirs. Washington insiders were aware of it, too, and were aware also how difficult that accomplishment had been. Familiar with the feelings of the Kennedy men toward the new president, many insiders had considered it simply impossible that Johnson would be able to persuade more than a few of them to stay. He had persuaded all of them to stay, and he had done it so fast. Johnson's intensity and persistence in carrying out this job was extraordinary, Evans and Novak wrote. There was no hesitation, no ceremony, no delay. Almost all of the job had been carried out in 3 days, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, those 3 days during which the nation had paid little attention to what Lyndon Johnson was doing. By the time on Monday afternoon that their beloved leader's body had been laid to rest, his men had agreed to stay and serve under his successor's flag. The end of the service at Arlington, to McGeorge Bundy, was like the fall of a curtain or the snapping of taut strings. And when the curtain came up again, it came up on Lyndon Johnson. After Kennedy's body was lowered into the ground at 3:34 p.m. that Monday, Johnson was driven back to the Executive Office Building. The vote on the Mundt bill was less than 24 hours away. Larry O'Brien had had enough time to mourn. When Johnson telephoned him at 4:40 p.m., he was sitting in his office with Ken O'Donnell, who was drinking and, intermittently, crying. And when the president called, O'Brien was reluctant even to talk to him. When Johnson used the same line he had used with him on Air Force One, "I'm most anxious for you to continue just like you have been, because I need you a lot more than he did," O'Brien sighed audibly into the receiver and said, "Mr. President, did you... Ken is here with me. Do you have any immediate problem?" Johnson said, "No, that he just wanted you to know how strongly I felt about you. I think you know the admiration I have for you, and..." O'Brien interrupted him. "I know that, Mr. President," he said in a very flat voice. Johnson said, "I don't expect you to love me as much as you did him, but I expect you will, after we've been around a while." "Right," O'Brien replied. But the time for that line, the time for begging, was over. If O'Brien truly cared about Kennedy's memory, he had a duty to it, and Johnson summoned him to his post. "I think it would be a terrible thing to Kennedy's memory to have this wheat sale thing repudiated," he said. O'Brien had to agree. "Yeah," he said. And Johnson's next words to Kennedy's congressional vote counter were less emotional than professional, one pro speaking to another. "I hope they got the votes in the Senate," he said. "Do you know anything about it?" How could O'Brien respond to a summons like that but obey? "I'll check that," he said, and with those words became, whatever his feelings about Johnson at that moment, effectively a member of his team. "Now what's important is that we check those votes pretty carefully," Johnson said. "Right," O'Brien replied. "I want somebody to give it a little attention, and then you let me know any suggestions you have, because we're in this thing right up to our ears," Johnson said. "I did tell Mansfield that I thought it would be a terrible thing to Kennedy's memory and a hell of a way to launch a new administration," Johnson said. "I agree," O'Brien said, "I agree." Changing out of the formal striped trousers and black tailcoat he had worn for the funeral and into a business suit, he had himself driven to Capitol Hill and went to work. Then Johnson had to meet with Adlai Stevenson on a problem that was, Theodore White wrote, after talking to Stevenson, abrupt, urgent, unpostponable. Stevenson had been scheduled to address the United Nations on Tuesday, in less than 24 hours, on America's policy on orbiting armed spacecraft. He felt the speech could not be canceled, lest that arouse suspicions of disarray in the American government. Instead of spacecraft, he felt, the subject should be the strongest possible reassurance to UN delegates, who were worried about Johnson's views, that the new president supported the international organization. Johnson approved the change in topic and the text. "President Johnson has directed me to affirm to this assembly that there will be no Johnson policy toward the United Nations, any more than there was a Kennedy policy," Stevenson told the UN the next day. "There was and is only a United States policy." Then it was time for the State Department reception for the foreign leaders who had come to Washington, except that the Democratic chairman of California, Jesse Unruh, whose support he might need in a few months, accompanied by two other key California Democrats, had been waiting at Cliff Carter's desk, hoping, as Carter's note to Johnson said, for a quick visit with you. The visit was held as quick as possible, noted one of Johnson's secretaries, and then he was at the State Department. This appearance, his first public appearance since the funeral, was before a small but very select audience. About as select an audience as could be found on the face of the earth, and there was, as one account put it, electricity. The glamour and glitter of this unprecedented gathering of world power under one roof, in State's three brilliantly lit top-floor reception rooms with their view of the Potomac, and, beyond it, Arlington Cemetery. The rooms were filled with sashes and turbans and medals. Queen Frederica of Greece led Emperor Haile Selassie to a couch, while nearby, Mikoyan of Russia fenced with De Gaulle of France. Everywhere one turned, there was a world-famous face. And as Johnson stood before a fireplace receiving heads of state, with Secretary of State Dean Rusk standing at his shoulder, two of Rusk's aides, his executive secretary Benjamin H. Reed, and State's chief of protocol, Andrew Biddle Duke, watching nearby, were apprehensive. These leaders were there, Duke was to say, to take the measure of Lyndon Johnson, and the State Department officials were anxious about how the measuring would go. If there was a focal point, in addition to the Kennedy Circle, of course, for uncertainty about the new president, it was at State, not in Dean Rusk's office, but among the officials below Rusk, the officials who, rightly or wrongly, had quailed at Johnson's openness and exuberance on his foreign travels, embarrassed at the impression of America that they felt he was conveying to the world, and who, aware of Kennedy's orders that he not be allowed to visit Russia, felt that their embarrassment had been shared by the late president. Reed was to recall that State's attempts to keep Johnson informed on foreign policy had never worked out terribly successfully. I think it would be foolish to pretend that it was otherwise because it wasn't. Whatever their feelings about Johnson, furthermore, State's diplomats knew that one wrong word could bring international complications, and knew also that there had been no time for them to give Johnson any but the most cursory briefing on the right words. Looking at the big Texan, he towered over everyone in the room but De Gaulle, who he felt had done such a poor job representing the United States in the past, Reed didn't know, he was to say, what to expect at this reception. But, he was to say, he certainly didn't expect what he got. The president had had a terribly busy day, he was to say, doing the thousand and one things that he needed to do in those desperate early days, and the briefing time was just non-existent. Reed had typed notes on 5x8 white cards, and we would put these little cards into his hand just moments before he would be greeting these people. Carrying out the instructions on some of the cards required delicacy, for Prince Kantal, Prime Minister of Cambodia, a country with whom American relations were in an advanced state of deterioration, the card read, "Tone, firm, no nonsense, though kindly. President Kennedy had a high regard for Prince Sihanouk. You share that regard. President Kennedy personally investigated the charges of U.S. complicity in the Khmer Saray plots and gave Prince Sihanouk his categorical assurances that they were false. The U.S. respects Cambodia's desire for neutrality and supports it, but if international guarantees are wanted, the right way to get them is not to begin by continuing to accuse the U.S. of complicity in plots." Watching Johnson now, however, Reed started to relax. Glancing at each card for a moment, the moment that was all he had, grasping the essence of it in an instant, he would work into the conversation points which we had suggested. Nor was it just with talking points that Johnson was making an impression. As each minister or prime minister or prince came up to him, Johnson would shake his hand, but then that hand wasn't released. Still holding it, Johnson would grin, and in almost every case, the prince or prime minister would grin back. From his earliest days campaigning in the Texas Hill Country as a gawky, awkward young politician, Johnson had displayed a remarkable gift for making an immediate connection with people he had never met before. Part of his technique was a handshake, which he turned into more than a handshake. Max Frankel of the New York Times, watching nearby, wrote, "The average dignitary received a firm hand clasp that was held for minutes if necessary, until condolences and wishes had been expressed. Older acquaintances received not only the prolonged handshake but also the covering clasp of the left hand. They were held there through longer remarks and usually broad smiles. Held firmly, but also in a friendly way, It was a technique that had worked with farmers and their wives, and it worked now with prime ministers. The State Department men saw, as Duke put it, that Johnson understood how he was being measured by them, and they saw that he measured up. He was marvelous, Duke says. He came away with a good deal of respect. Mikoyan approached, flanked by Ambassador Dobrynin and an interpreter. A private meeting had been scheduled for the following morning with the shrewdest man of the Russian leadership, but this tonight was a first impression. State wanted Johnson to project willingness to continue his predecessor's efforts to ease tensions between the two superpowers, together with firmness in protecting America's interests. Taking Mikoyan's hand, Johnson chatted with him for about 90 seconds and posed for a photograph without smiles. Although the expression on Johnson's face was not unpleasant, the photographs showed a very shrewd man squinting up at a very tough one. And then came the one-on-one meetings, in Rusk's office on the 7th floor, with Ikeda of Japan and Pearson of Canada, after, of course, de Gaulle. Johnson had met with the French president once before, and it had been an unpleasant occasion as de Gaulle, with his customary haughtiness, had lectured Johnson on America's role in the world. The unpleasantness had been rekindled in Johnson's mind by a report Bundy had handed to him that morning. At a recent meeting between de Gaulle and an Allied ambassador, the report said, de Gaulle had indicated that despite America's NATO commitments, Western Europe would not be able to rely on the United States in the event of a Soviet invasion. In both world wars, he had said, America had arrived late. Only Pearl Harbor had brought us into the second one. When, shortly before the reception, Bundy had told him that his first private meeting would be with Le Grand Charles, Johnson had for a moment reacted with a lack of enthusiasm so noticeable that Bundy asked, "Does that bother you?" "Nah, a little," Johnson had said. He had been hoping his talk with de Gaulle could be brief. "I thought I'd sandwich him in. Disagreeable. See, he had urged that we..." But then he caught himself. He was president now. "All right," he told Bundy, "I'll follow your judgment." When de Gaulle now asserted in Johnson's recollection that differences between the two countries had been exaggerated and that Frenchmen knew they could always count on the support of the United States, "I suppressed a smile," Johnson wants to recall. And he evidently suppressed it successfully. No one watching the two men talk would have suspected there had ever been anything disagreeable in their relationship. Watching from across the room as Johnson met one-on-one with the real heavyweights was, Reed says, quite a sight. It was done with real skill by him under the maximum of difficulties. What were his feelings about Johnson by the end of the reception? The greatest feeling of admiration. It was quite a show. Then he had to rush back to the executive office building. As he had been walking down the hill at Arlington that afternoon, he had noticed a number of state governors in the crowd, and their presence, as one account gives it, had suddenly registered on him, and he had realized that, trying as he was to meet with the nation's leaders to build rapport with them and to build their confidence in him, here, in the governors, were whole handfuls of key leaders, chief executives of the states of the Union, all in Washington at the same time, ready to hand. And he had thought, moreover, thought in an instant, biographies of a writer or an artist would call such a moment an epiphany, of a way to make use of governors. To break the logjam on Capitol Hill, he needed to influence senators and representatives, needed levers outside Congress to put pressure on it. And he had learned it during the 1960 campaign that governors could put quite a bit of pressure on senators and representatives. Immediately after his return to 274 after the funeral, he had told his staff to invite the governors to a meeting in his office at 8 o'clock that evening. With the funeral over, some of them would probably be leaving already, he said. Stop them. William Scranton of Pennsylvania was, in fact, waiting in line to board an airplane back to Philadelphia when he was asked to return. It wasn't possible to get them all, but the staff got 35, and they were waiting in 274's conference room when he hurried in at 8:30, apologizing for being late, saying he had just been talking with General de Gaulle, and the talk had lasted longer than expected. The conference table had been pushed back against the rear wall to make more room. Three photographers were standing on it. And folding chairs had been brought in and placed in rows facing his desk. But there weren't enough of those chairs for all the governors, and some were sitting in the green conference table chairs that were now flanking his desk, and others were crammed onto a couch flanking the desk on the other side, and aides and a few reporters lined the walls. So overcrowded was the room that it wasn't just the fluorescent lights that kept the setting from being dignified or impressive. But the setting wasn't going to matter. Talking points for the evening, mostly platitudes, had been hastily prepared by Valenti, and they were lying on the desk in front of him. But after a minute or two, the platitudes were forgotten, and Lyndon Johnson got to the point. "We do have this problem tonight, and that is the business of the government going forward," he said. "We live under a system of checks and balances," he said, and, "I will tell you that Congress has exercised its power to check the executive, all right." He told them how bad the problem was, in terms they could all understand, for they were chief executives too, which meant they also had budgets to pass, and resistance against passing them from legislators. "I have a budget that has to go to Congress December 15th, he said. There were demands on him to increase the budget. "The Secretary of Defense told me last night that he would have to have close to $1 billion extra to keep up our defense guard. The Space Administrator said that unless we want to cut back and abandon our trip to the moon, he has to have $750 million more than he had last year." Congress had blocked passage of the budget. It had blocked passage of the Civil Rights Bill. "We have a good education bill which has passed the House, and it is over in the Senate. We have one that has passed the Senate and is over in the House." So an education bill was blocked, too. Other important bills were blocked. "Congress has gone a record 10 months without finalizing action on so many of these bills. This is November, and this is the first time in 32 years that we have not passed an appropriations bill. So," he said, "I need your help." He explained what type of help he was thinking of. "I want to appeal to you to get your delegations, their congressional delegations, their states' senators and representatives, to help us break through this impasse." He needed them to help influence public opinion back in their states. "I not only need your hands, I need your voice," he said. He couldn't make Congress legislate by himself, he said. "If there is anything you can do to help us get action in this period of time when we are faced with this tragic experience of ours, we will be grateful." The budget had to have enough money for defense, he said. "We have had hopes of easing tensions with Russia," he said, "but that does not mean we have to lessen our strength. That means we have to maintain it. We have to lead from a position of strength. So we have to maintain that defense posture, because if we let down our guard, that is a written invitation for more trouble instead of less tension." He appealed to their pride in their country. "I am seeing 15 leaders in the morning from foreign countries, and all of them have their doubts as to what is going to happen in America. To hesitate the slightest, I think, would be a great risk in compromising our whole system as a leader of the world." And he explained to them why they should help regardless of their party affiliation. "You are great patriots, and no single party has a single mortgage on patriotism. I have been a Democrat all my life. I cannot point to any members of my party who are more patriotic than members of the other party." Ike understood this, he told them. "I sat here yesterday with the great president of this country who led our forces to victory. He came in yesterday to offer his help. He spent 2.5 hours here. We did not discuss his party or politics. We just discussed what needed to be done in this country to save it." He was getting worked up now, revved up. His desk was up on blocks, so that he would appear bigger than he was, but he didn't need the blocks to look bigger now. As he went on, emotions, passion, began to pour out of him so that he was again, for the first time in 3 years, the Lyndon Johnson who got bigger as he talked to you. And suddenly his talk was on a different level, about larger issues than budgets or bipartisanship. "We have hate abroad in the world. Hate internationally, hate domestically, where a president was assassinated, and then they take the law into their own hands and kill the assassin," he said. "That is not our system. We have to do something about that. We have to do something about this hate, and you have to get to the root of hate. The roots are poverty and disease and illiteracy. He had been sitting erect behind his desk, smiling, friendly, dignified, at the beginning of his talk. He wasn't erect now, but hunched forward over the desk, arms leaning on the pages that he had long since stopped reading from, and as he talked he leaned further and further forward toward the men sitting in front of him, his hands sometimes open in entreaty and sometimes clenched into fists. He had noticed something in the State Department briefing cards, he said. The people I talk to tonight out of 100 nations, there are only 6 of them that have an income of as much as $80 a month. We don't really recognize how lucky and fortunate we are until something tragic like this happens to us. Here is our president shot in the head, and his wife holds his skull in her lap as they drive down the street. Here is our governor who looked around and said, "Oh, no, no, no," and because he turned, a bullet just missed his heart. It went through his lung, down into his leg, and tore his left hand off. And then, yesterday, they take the law into their own hands. We have to do something to stop that hate. And the way we have to do it is to meet the problem of injustice that exists in this land, meet the problem of inequality that exists in this land, meet the problem of poverty that exists in this land, and the unemployment that exists in this land. The best way to meet those problems, Lyndon Johnson said, is to pass the tax bill and get some more jobs and get some more investments and, incidentally, get more revenues and taxes, and pass the civil rights bill so that we can say to the Mexican in California, or the Negro in Mississippi, or the Oriental on the West Coast, or the Johnsons in Johnson City, that we are going to treat you all equally and fairly, and you are going to be judged on merit and not ancestry, not on how you spell your name. Forget your party for a moment, Lyndon Johnson told the men before him. We are going to have plenty of time after the conventions to get out and campaign and talk about ourselves and our merits. Let's talk about the country until then. And let's not just talk about it, Lyndon Johnson said. Let's get some action on it and do something. Do something. Lyndon Johnson wasn't smiling and friendly anymore. When he said the "let's do something," he just snarled at Valenti was to say. There had been exaggeration in his description of the scene in Dallas. John Connolly's hand had not been torn off. But there was a vividness in the description, too. Not John Kennedy's head in Jackie's lap, but his skull in her lap. The vividness of a great storyteller whose words caught men up in their grip. And there was a vividness in the part of his talk that wasn't exaggerated that caught them up, too. The only thing you could see moving in that room was the reporters' pencils, Valenti was to recall. No one moved. No one budged. The room was absolutely still. No one took their eyes from his face. Reedy was very proud. Others were finally seeing what the Senate cloakroom had seen. Johnson finished by talking for a moment about himself. I am not the best man in the world at this job, and I was thrown into it through circumstances, but I am in it, and I am not going to run from it, he said. I am going to be at it from daylight to midnight, and with your help and God's help, we are going to make not ourselves proud that we are Americans, but we are going to make the rest of the world proud that there is an American in it. Some of the governors facing him had risen to their office through their capacity for leadership, and others had learned leadership since they were in the office. But one way or another, many of them had learned to know leadership when they saw it. When Johnson finished, they stood and applauded him. A reporter asked Pat Brown his reaction to the speech. This was the Pat Brown who 3 years before had been thoroughly repelled by Johnson's manner. Astounded, Brown said. Others saw it too, including men more accustomed to dealing with hard, cold numbers than with intangibles, the economists who had been preparing President Kennedy's budget. 6 of them had been waiting outside during Johnson's meeting with the governors. The administration's 3 top advisors on economic policy, Dillon of Treasury, Heller of the Council of Economic Advisors, and Gordon of the Bureau of the Budget, who called themselves Kennedy's Troika, after a Russian sleigh that is pulled by 3 horses, and their top assistants, Treasury Undersecretary Henry H. Fowler, Gardner Ackley of the Council, and Budget Deputy Director Elmer Statz. As soon as Johnson began talking to them, they realized that the sleigh had a very different driver now. They were conscious, they were to say, of some of what Johnson had done that day, marching in the procession past 1,000 windows after his predecessor had been shot from a window, attending the funeral, dealing with de Gaulle and Mikoyan and scores of foreign leaders, and then, as they sat waiting outside with the governors, dealing with the investigation of the murders in Dallas, as well as, they were sure, carrying out a dozen other tasks of which they were not aware. They knew his day must have begun early that morning. Actually, it had begun at about 6:30 in the morning, and their meeting began at 9:15 that night, almost 15 hours later. But, Ackley was to record in his notes on the meeting, the president showed no signs of his tiring day, looked fit and vigorous, was affable and relaxed, but always in command. In command. The most impressive thing, Ackley wrote, was the confident way in which he approached the whole problem, not necessarily implying that he knew the answers, but that he knew the score and that the problem could be solved. All we had to do was to decide how to tackle it. And a moment later they realized that he had decided, that he already knew how he was going to deal with the problem of getting a tax reduction bill through Congress that had stymied them for almost a year. "What about your tax bill?" he asked Dillon. And before Dillon could reply, Ackley wrote, he answered his own question. Dillon and the other members of Kennedy's economic team had believed that getting the budget down to $101.5 or $102 billion, reasonably close to the $100 billion figure Harry Byrd kept mentioning, would satisfy Byrd and his fellow Finance Committee conservatives. The previous year's budget had been $98.8 billion. Mandatory built-in increases would add $1.8 billion more, new expenses required under legislation already passed and signed, an additional $1.6 billion. Even if no department or agency was given a raise, the total therefore currently stood at $102.2 billion. Dillon felt that figure might possibly be reduced to the $101.5 billion figure, but no further. But Johnson told Dillon that he had been checking with senators on finance, the president indicating pretty clear knowledge of every vote, Ackley noticed, and the team's belief was wrong. The $100 billion wasn't an estimate, a rough figure, but a hard one, not an approximation of what Byrd wanted, but a limit, a psychological barrier that should not be breached, in the words of one senatorial observer, a magic number with a deep symbolic significance to the chairman. No peacetime budget had ever reached that figure, and he was determined that this budget wouldn't reach it either. Unless the budget was reduced below that figure, the tax bill, with its savings to taxpayers of $11 billion, and the resultant 3-to-1 stimulus for the economy that would produce badly needed new jobs and programs, wasn't going to be released by the committee and sent to the full Senate for a vote. There was no choice, Johnson told Dillon. We won't have the votes to get it to the floor unless we tell them the budget will be about $100 billion. It was as simple as that, Johnson said, according to Ackley's notes. If you want to get an $11 billion tax bill, you're going to have to give up $1.5 billion of expenditures. Which would you rather have? The troika began to tug against the reins. To get the budget down to $101.5 or $102 billion, Kermit Gordon said, they had already had to cut from it so many items that shouldn't have been cut, including every single new dam and irrigation project, and to drastically reduce expenditures for reclamation and rural electrification. Johnson interrupted Gordon. He knew what that $101.5 billion meant, he said. He's been hearing about it from Freeman, Wirtz and Company, all of Heller's liberal friends. In a manner that Ackley described as half-jokingly but pointedly, he told Heller, tell them to lay off, Walter. Tell them to quit lobbying. I'm for them. He was a liberal, he said. I want an expanding economy. The budget should actually be far higher than the figures they were talking about, and he knew it. They don't need to waste my time and theirs with their memorandums and their phone calls. But if they didn't get the budget down below $100 billion, Byrd was not going to allow the tax bill to get to the floor. Heller tried to argue that the $101.5 billion budget already represented such substantial economies that the president could defend it persuasively. I can defend 101.5, Lyndon Johnson said. You take on Senator Byrd. He had talked with the conservatives and knew what they wanted. Unless you get that budget down around $100 billion, you won't pee one drop. They seemed to feel there were alternatives to giving Byrd what he wanted, he told the six economic advisers. There weren't. And he gave them a lesson in political realities. You couldn't get around the Senate, he said, telling them about a president at the very height of his popularity, who had tried it, attempting in 1938 to unseat Southern conservative senators by going into their states to campaign against them. Of course, you could try to take it to the country. FDR tried that with his tremendous majority and got licked, he said. It wouldn't work if they tried it now, either. He gave them a lesson in parliamentary tactics, a masterclass in Senate tactics. As Ackley recorded, the Civil Rights Bill came up. The president said he had told President Kennedy not to send it up at least until after the appropriations bills were passed. Once it was sent up, Russell gave the orders to stall, to do nothing, and that's what happened. And that's what was going to continue to happen on the tax bill and the budget and the appropriations bills unless the conservatives got what they wanted. Economists could talk all they wanted, he told the economists. The reality was the Senate Finance Committee, and Harry Byrd. You had to give up something to buy off Byrd, he told them. And what they had to give up was that $1,150,000,000. His message hadn't gotten through to the administration before, but it was his administration now, and they heard what he was saying. Dylan agreed that you had to pay the price to get the tax bill, but it was worth it, Ackley's notes say. Then when you have it, you can do what you want, Dylan added, and Johnson agreed. Like Ike did, talked economy and then spent. And, at the end, Heller agreed that if it were a real choice between a tax bill right away and $1.5 billion of expenditure, it was worth the price. The deal would be made, Johnson indicated. It might take a week to work it out. The Troika and their deputies filed out. They had been meeting with Johnson for about an hour. When the meeting had started, they had felt the tax bill was stalled. Now they saw a way it could be passed. They felt it would be passed. Had the governors been impressed with Lyndon Johnson? So were they. The budget tax bill situation contained so many complexities. They had been grasped so quickly. Decisions had had to be made. They had been made. So quickly. When the economic advisers had entered his office, their tax bill and budget had been trapped, the government still operating as it had been operating for months under a makeshift budget, with the budget for the year to come still in limbo. If, to use Lyndon Johnson's terms, they had been mired in a congressional swamp, caught, unable to move, simply circling round and round, needing someone to assume command, to provide direction, needing, in other words, a leader, by the time they left an hour later, they felt they had one, affable and relaxed, but always in command, confident that the problem could be solved. A leader who might, in fact, have found at last a way out of the swamp. As for America as a whole, during the past 3 days the country, its eyes riveted on the memorial ceremonies for John F. Kennedy, had paid little attention to Lyndon Johnson, and there was widespread uneasiness about what lay ahead, a nation's need to feel that, its leader dead, it had a new leader. But by the end of those 3 days, while America as a whole had not yet paid much attention to Lyndon Johnson, people who had, during those days, dealt with him in person, face-to-face or over the telephone, the Troika, the governors, the princes and prime ministers, the worried young State Department aides, his own ministers, Bundy, Rusk, McNamara, those who had watched him up close as he wrestled with problems that had to be resolved, that could not wait, knew by the end of those 3 days that America did, in fact, have one. The drama into which Lyndon Johnson had been plunged was a drama that had begun with the transfer of power, great power, in an instant, without warning. It had continued with the assumption and use of that power in its very early stages, in its first 3 days in what is called the transition between the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, the passage of power from one administration to the other. And in these early stages, already perilous because of circumstances that made it difficult for him to create an impression of continuity and confidence, It was a passage through uncharted waters, a passage that in significant ways was without parallel in American history. No precedents existed to guide Lyndon Johnson through some of the problems that confronted him. He had had to create his own precedents, and had done so with such success that Times Sidey, writing years later, said, "Even now one must marvel at Johnson's total grasp of the machinery of government." There was no script for what he had done, Sidey said, and yet his assumption of power was flawless. And by the end of the third day, or to be more precise, by early the next morning, Tuesday morning, America had a leader who had assured himself of victory in his first battle. "I want somebody to give it a little attention," Lyndon Johnson had told Larry O'Brien about the month bill, and O'Brien had gone to work. And no sooner had Johnson finished with the troika at about 10:15 Monday night than he gave it a little attention himself, working to defeat the bill by telephoning not only senators who were undecided about it, but senators who had announced unequivocally that they would support it. There was no time to lose. The vote was only a few hours away. "All of us worked far into the night on that," Johnson was to write. He had a strong argument to use, that a vote for Munt would be a repudiation of Jack Kennedy and of him. "He came hard to the point," reported Evans and Novak, who spoke to several of the recipients of his calls, "transforming the issue from a question of foreign policy toward Moscow into a vote of confidence in the new president. In essence," he said, "do you want the first action of the United States Senate to be a posthumous repudiation of John F. Kennedy and a slap in the face of Lyndon Johnson?" Framing the issue that way changed votes, and by about 11 o'clock that night, he had enough so that he knew he had won. Among them were two Democrats, Russell Long of Louisiana and Thomas McIntyre of New Hampshire. But for his purpose, to show he was in charge, he wanted not just a victory, but a rout. "That wheat thing, I hope that gets murdered," he said. He kept making calls, and the vote against the bill the next day would be 57-36. "Wheat bill, first Johnson victory," the headlines said. During his years in the Senate, as year by year, during his time as assistant leader and then leader and majority leader, the legend of Lyndon Johnson had grown. One element that had contributed to his mastery of the Senate had been his intuition, his rare gift for seeing the larger implications in an individual bill. Another element had been his decisiveness, his gift, equally rare, not only for sensing in an instant, in the midst of the cut and thrust and parry of debate on the Senate floor, which way the Senate's mood was running on a bill, and not only if the mood was running in the wrong direction for sensing the moment at which the tide might be turned, but a gift as well not only for sensing the moment but for seizing it, for launching on the instant maneuvers that turned the tide. 3 years, though, it had been since he had had an opportunity to use those gifts. He hadn't forgotten how. Though the scenes Lyndon Johnson had played that day, with the 100 heads of state, the 35 governors, the troika, had been crucial, they had been played before small audiences, and before such audiences, the smaller the better, he had usually performed well throughout his career. But on Wednesday, in his address to the joint session of Congress, he was going to have to appear before the entire country. He was well aware that, as Newsweek warned its readers that week, while he could be charming, informed, and persuasive in man-to-man talk, he often seems corny and tedious in public address, in prepared full-length speeches to large audiences. With very rare exceptions, such as the talks at the Zembo Mosque, informal addresses before large audiences he had, all his life, been unable to conquer his tendency to talk too fast, to rush over and blur the points he wanted to make. And the audience for this address would be not merely the 1,000 or so people seated before him and in the galleries above, but the tens of millions who would be watching him on television, the medium that had always been particularly unkind to him, the medium in which the impression he made with his bellowing, hectoring, vigorously gesticulating style had almost invariably merited the corny and tedious adjectives, and other adjectives as well, ponderous, dogmatic, loud, overbearing, irritating, off-putting. On Wednesday, in addition, he would be following onto the television screen a very hard act for anyone to follow. the greatest political performer who had ever appeared on television, one whose grace and wit, handsome face and boyish smile had been made newly vivid to America by the replays of his speeches and press conferences that had been on that screen hour after hour for 3 days. A lot was riding on this speech for Lyndon Johnson. The country wasn't familiar with him, didn't feel it knew him. This address would, to a great extent, be its first impression of him, and first impressions can be lasting. As Times' Loy Miller put it, overshadowing everything else Johnson had done since taking office, it would be beyond doubt the most important speech of his political life, because from it a very shaken citizenry would form judgments of him, take away impressions and opinions, which it would be hard to change. The American people, Miller wrote, are anxious to size up their new president, anxious to believe that he has what it takes. But if, at the end of that speech, they didn't believe that, everything he had accomplished in the past 3 days wouldn't matter very much. If it failed, all the doubts, oh, more than doubts, all the suspicion of him would only be fortified, and nothing he said in the future would erase that original mistake. Another Miller, the author Merle Miller, was to write. Johnson himself was aware of the stakes. As Bill Moyers told Loy Miller, he knew that the people watching it were burning with the question, who is this man? He felt that it would be setting off a chain reaction of opinion about the president, and he felt that since he was in office by accident, it was very important to show people right now that his administration would not be government by accident. But what if he didn't show them that? He had understood from the first moments after the assassination the importance of instilling confidence in him in the American people. After the speech, they would either have confidence in him or not. And if they didn't, all the assumptions about the inevitability of renomination for a sitting president would be meaningless. Speculation about rival candidates would begin immediately. A lot riding for him, and a lot riding for America. Should the speech fail to instill confidence in him, the anxiety and unease would still be there, and John Kennedy's programs, civil rights, the tax cut, education, foreign aid, all the legislation that had been stalled for so long in Congress, would still be stalled. Men who regarded themselves as his friends, who had known him or worked with him for a long time and had heard him make many speeches, were very worried. Congressman Kilgore, who had over the years sat in on many coaching sessions in which Johnson was told not to wave his arms and bellow and talk too fast, and who had many times watched Johnson try to follow that advice and fail, telephoned Liz Carpenter to tell her he must follow it this time, that this was the most important speech he would ever give, and that he must not wave his arms from the rostrum of the House, he must not shout or speak too fast, and he must say the right things. Having worked with Johnson for a long time, Kilgore expected the response to such advice to be rage. Instead, on Tuesday, Johnson invited him to the White House to review drafts of the speech and also to ride in his limousine when he went to Capitol Hill to deliver it. When he went to the White House that Tuesday, Kilgore didn't wear his customary pearl-gray Texas Stetson. The Texas image was more infuriating than ever to some people at that moment, he was to explain. The worst service his friends could perform for Johnson would be to strut in and out of the White House wearing Stetson hats. And he told Johnson he wouldn't ride to the Capitol with him. The best help he could give his old friend, he told the president, was to stay away from him in public. The president must not convey the impression that his closest friends were conservative Texas politicians. He went to the speech in a taxi. Johnson knew some of what he wanted to say, telling Busby on Sunday morning to begin drafting the speech. He mentioned a phrase Kennedy had used in his inaugural address. He wanted to play on that phrase. Also, on a notepad on his desk in 274, he had begun scrawling words among the doodles. And one of the words was hate. Assassination, product of hate, he scribbled. Get rid of hate. And he knew who he wanted as the speech's principal drafter, the man he felt was the finest speechwriter of them all. When, on Saturday, he had asked Ted Sorensen to begin putting some thoughts together, the young Nebraskan had been too dazed with grief to respond. But when Johnson telephoned him again on Sunday, he agreed, because of his love for and loyalty to his dead leader, and to what he had stood for, to commit LBJ to carrying on Kennedy's program. Although drafts had been solicited from State and Treasury and from individuals like John Kenneth Galbraith, following Sorensen's agreement, all drafts were submitted to him, even Busby's. Sorensen gave them short shrift, except for one three-paragraph segment from Busby, the segment that made use of Kennedy's inaugural phrase, that was so good and that dovetailed so perfectly with Sorensen's purposes that it stayed in through every draft. Sorensen's final draft was very much a tribute to Kennedy from Johnson. It included the line, "I who cannot fill his shoes must occupy his desk." That sentence, not surprisingly, didn't survive, as was the case with the most extravagant of Sorensen's other tributes to Kennedy. "No man has ever done so much for so many in so little time," for example. Johnson liked the rest of the draft, although feeling it needed what Abe Fortas called a little corning up. He had Fortas and the master of corn, Hubert Humphrey, come to the Elms that evening. After dinner, Fortas, Humphrey, and several other Johnson aides worked on the speech at the dining room table. While the corning was completed rather quickly, a fierce debate then erupted over the emphasis to be given in the speech to civil rights. A great issue was whether he would recommend congressional action on rights, Fortas was to recall, and if so, whether he should put that as a number one item. Several of the men at the table said that pressing for passage of a civil rights bill would jeopardize the tax cut and the appropriations bills, and would shatter Johnson's relationship with the Southerners who had always been the base of his strength in Congress, and whose support he would need there now. The discussion had gone on, Fortas was to say, for hours, until about 2:30 in the morning, with Johnson sitting silently listening when, Fortas says, an incident occurred which renewed my pride in him. One of the wise, practical people around the table urged Johnson not to press for civil rights in his first speech, because there was no chance of passage, and a president shouldn't waste his power on lost causes, no matter how worthy the cause might be. "The presidency has only a certain amount of coinage to expend, and you oughtn't to expend it on this," he said. "Well, what the hell's a presidency for?" Lyndon Johnson replied. Then the speech was finished. It was sent off to the White House to be typed in large type and placed in the black loose-leaf notebook Johnson would take to Capitol Hill with him. The next morning at about 11 o'clock, he closed the door to the Oval Office and worked alone editing the speech. Moyers had never seen him do that before. His edits were small, but they added drama. The text in front of Lyndon Johnson included the phrase, "the dream of education for our youth." Johnson changed it to "the dream of education for our children." The text spoke of "the dream of jobs for all who seek them." "For all who seek them and need them," Johnson wrote in. The text urged the passage of Kennedy's tax bill, "for which he fought." "For which he fought all this long year," Johnson added. It urged the passage of Kennedy's civil rights bill, "for which he fought." "For which he fought so long," Johnson added. And the text wasn't being edited just for drama. It was being edited by this man who knew he had never been able to speak effectively before large audiences, to help him speak effectively this time, the most important time. To try to keep himself from rushing through it, blurring its meaning and its force, as for 30 years, despite every effort he had almost invariably done, he had it retyped in one-sentence paragraphs in an attempt to make himself pause between the sentences. Then, because he had used that device before and it hadn't worked, he reinforced it by writing in hand, between many paragraphs, a reminder to himself, "pause." And then, as if he was afraid that he would nevertheless still speak too fast, he wrote in, "pause, pause." Before a one-line paragraph, he wrote in, "pause, pause." Then, after the paragraph, he wrote again, "pause, pause." For 30 years, talking too fast, he had almost invariably rushed through key words he should have emphasized. When he finished editing this text, it was filled with underlining of words he wanted to emphasize. Then he was in the car with Sorensen and Valenti, motorcycle outriders in front, Secret Service and staff cars behind, driving fast, past 100 flags flying at half-mast from the government fortresses along Pennsylvania Avenue, with above them, on the building's roofs, policemen with rifles outlined black against the sky. The spectators, however, were sparse, Tom Wicker noticed. Even in the East Plaza of the Capitol, as he got out of his car, only a few people watched and applauded. Then he was standing in a corridor outside the House chamber, behind doorkeeper Fishbait Miller, and then the tall double doors swung open and Fishbait stepped through and announced, "Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States," and started to walk up the center aisle to the dais,